Hi, I'm Connie Loizos.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Hello, I am exhausted. This week, TechCrunch hosted its annual TechCrunch Disrupt event in downtown San Francisco, and I'm very happy to say that it was a huge success. I hate to say the energy was palpable because that sounds ridiculous, but I swear to you, it really was. The place was brimming with founders and investors and students and operators, and everyone just seemed happy, even when there was a line down the hall for a session that was already standing room only. Disrupt is a big deal, as many in San Francisco know, but this year was definitely special, with more than 12,000 attendees at the Moscone Center, and more stages than ever before, and also more sponsors than ever before. I think we had upwards of 90 companies participate, but it was also just somehow smoother. I will say that because I'm now the general manager and editor-in-chief of TechCrunch, that a lot of people have congratulated me specifically on the show, but I will tell you, every single person pitches in to create these disrupt experiences, from edit to sales to marketing to audience development to our outstanding event operations team. They're all just really, really good at what they do, and I am privileged to be part of the organization. Speaking of which, I did not have the time or energy to record a special podcast for you this week, but I did talk with two very smart, charismatic investors on stage. Reed Jobs, who is the son of Steve Jobs and who recently launched a venture fund whose mission it is to vanquish cancer, and Katie Hahn, the former federal prosecutor turned Coinbase board member and crypto VC, who was the first female general partner at Andreessen Horowitz and just 4 years later launched her own venture fund. As it happens, she closed her debut fund just as the market was turning, but across all of her work as a VC, she has so far managed to avoid the many companies that have imploded spectacularly over the last year. We talked about both things yesterday on stage. I really enjoyed both of these sit-downs. Each runs around 30 minutes, helpful to know as you're diving into them, but hopefully you will learn a thing or two. I certainly did. In the meantime, stay tuned for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Affinity is changing the way VCs manage relationships and increasing deal flow. By aggregating the data exhaust produced by daily interactions and communications and analyzing it with machine learning, Affinity delivers up-to-the-minute insights into professional relationships, unlocking new introductions to key decision makers, and giving you a holistic view of your team's networks in a centralized, automatically updated database without any manual upkeep. Affinity works with over 1,600 investment firms across venture capital, investment banking, private equity, and consulting, where sales are more personal, collaborative, and driven by relationships. Affinity, opening doors to help you close deals faster. Learn more at affinity.co. That's affinity.co.
So, Reed, thank you so much for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure, Connie. And I want to echo that congratulations to you as you assume this great new role as editor-in-chief.
Oh, thank you. That's so sweet of you to say.
Yeah, thank absolutely.
Thank you. So, Reed, you have one of the most famous names, last names in Silicon Valley, yet people don't know you yet. What would you like for them to know about you?
Oh, that's such a nice question. You know, all I really care about in this world is making a huge difference for cancer patients. And what we really do at Yosemite and what I've wanted to do my entire life is to make cancer non-lethal in our lifetimes. If we can be a part of that, that is exactly what I want to do and what I would love to be known for. But ultimately, notoriety is really low on my list of priorities. What I really care about the most is being involved with amazing science, but especially making great companies and translating those into patients as soon as possible, because patients are the ultimate arbiters for how well we're doing. So patient difference is really what we're at.
And so you have a specific plan to do that. So you took the wraps off of a venture fund last month, I guess, last month. a $200 million venture fund, and you run alongside it a donor-advised fund. So tell me a little bit about what you have cooking there.
So it's a structure that we actually have pioneered at Yosemite. So it's pretty unusual, and it's something that I'd love to get an opportunity to talk about because it's something that we're very excited to debut, but also something that we hope other people will eventually copy. So the way that it works is our venture fund is a very traditional venture fund, with one big exception. And that is that there's a percentage of the fund, it's small, it's only 2.5%, that goes into a donor-advised fund, which is a type of nonprofit entity that one doesn't own, but that they can still direct. That capital is then earmarked for grants, which is far more akin to seed funding in the biotech ecosystem than it would be philanthropy in other areas. And the reason why we're doing this is we've really piloted this at Emerson, and through partnering with the best researchers in the world on their best projects, we then can not only de-risk science that we then turn into companies, but we also get a network of the best KOLs in the world. And we've done this long enough that we've been lucky to support about 500 labs so far and have a really big footprint across the academic ecosystem. Those are, you know, connections and insights that we're going to be able to take with us as we make our investment decisions too. I want to pause though and just mention the way that we've structured this means that we have absolutely no IP or royalty rights to any of the grants that we do. I like to keep things really simple and really easy. And for me, that really means when we do a venture investment, we have to look at it on its merits of profitability and scalability. But when we do grants, we don't take any IP strings and we just do it as a pure philanthropic gift.
That's great. And I'm just curious, when you're dealing with donor advised funds, do the donors have any say in how that money is distributed, or that's entirely up to you?
That's entirely at our discretion.
Okay. And so this is sort of analogous to what you were doing at Emerson Collective, your mother's philanthropic and business organization. So why did you feel compelled to start your own thing, Yosemite?
Absolutely. So Emerson has had branches of its scale out in the public markets before. There's a group called Earthshot, which is a fantastic fund that works on the climate space, which similarly has now taken on external capital outside of Emerson. So for my team, it was a real natural evolution. I'll tell you, we're really proud to debut this model because it's something that other people can actually replicate. There's nothing here that's the province of cancer. You could absolutely do this for neurodegenerative diseases, for autoimmune diseases, and we hope other people will. And then finally, my team and I are, you know, all of a similar stage in our lives, and we wanted a little independence, and we wanted to have our own firm. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that.
That's great. I just wondered, you know, this does kind of put you in the public spotlight maybe for the first time, and you've already said it's nothing that you're terribly interested in. I'm just wondering how that feels.
It feels like a remarkable privilege and honor to be able to promote great science, great research, and really educate people on the fact that what we've done and seen in cancer outcomes in just the last 20 years is the very beginning of what is likely to happen over the next 20 years. And that is the optimization and really the dissemination of next generation therapies, mostly immunotherapies, but gene editing ones as well, to a broader range of diseases. So just to give you one small example, so I started working in cancer labs when my father got sick, really as soon as I could. He was diagnosed when I was 12. I at 15 started working in labs at Stanford. And at that point, what was really cutting edge was genomic sequencing. Mm. And I worked in a lab of colorectal cancer, and it was a type of that which was hereditary. And it was a terrible outcome. I mean, people would get colectomies at 35. It was almost a guaranteed prognosis of getting colon cancer in your lifetime. Really, really terrible. And you know, we found this certain mutational signatures there, and basically it had a crazy load of mutations, like millions of mutations. These cells were so out of control. But from the beginning of immunotherapy, when it began to be tested in that, the difference between those cancer cells and the rest of your body is so stark that even today's immunotherapy works marvelously in that type of colon cancer. Mm. And in my lifetime, I've already seen one area go from just absolute, really, really poor prognosis to something now that is widely treatable and has a really great long-term survival rate. So that's one example, but it's very illustrative of what we're seeing now with just the first iteration of this technology. Optimizing things like immunotherapy, CAR T cells, it'll take quite a while. Biotech is, you know, much slower than tech, which is unfortunate, but we have to be really deliberate and safe. And as we get and optimize those to the rest of the market, we're really excited to bring them out to a lot of other indications.
That's great. You know, I'm just curious, Daryl mentioned that you never wanted to be a venture capitalist, and I know that you studied pre-med. Did you ever think about starting a company, or do you just feel like you can have much more impact doing what you're doing?
Well, I think I can have a much more impact doing what I'm doing at this stage. Given the trends in the market, and really in science, it's really outpacing what any one company is likely able to do. I also, you know, am just innately very competitive. And, you know, my family, if you're going to start a company, it's got to be a hit.
It's a tall bar, I'm sure, in the Jobs household. I wanted to ask, if you had taken any of your team with you. I just met one of your wonderful colleagues, Anna, who I know came from Thrive Capital.
Yes, I'm proud to say that we brought actually the entire investment team.
Oh, okay, great.
From what was previously the Emerson Collective Health team into Yosemite. So our track record and experience, that's all carried over.
Oh, great.
Which I'm very proud of. We didn't lose anybody.
Okay, because I was wondering what would make sort of like a Yosemite company investment versus Emerson. But Emerson's not doing this at all anymore.
That's correct. Emerson's no longer doing life science investing. They will still do some healthcare, you know, tech investing. Mm-hmm. But on the life sciences side, that's really now through Yosemite.
Okay, so cancer cures, broadly speaking, is what you're focused on. How do you think about your approach? I mean, how many different sort of baskets are you looking at, and what is your priority here?
Well, again, we like to say we want to make cancer non-lethal. We're wary of the word cure. It's been abused in this industry a lot. And, you know, we really want to be very cautious about what we're going to be promising that we can deliver here. But ultimately, I'd say the three areas we really focus on are early detection, which is so critical. I mean, every cancer we have a way to detect it early, you have a commensurately lower mortality. And, you know, right now we have, you know, some great ones like PSA, mammograms, colonoscopies. Those are, you know, work quite well. But, you know, for the rest of cancers, it's really, really a crapshoot. And more often than not, things are caught when they're late and they're metastatic and they're far more dangerous. So things like liquid biopsies and actually a lot of AI in, you know, scans like MRIs and PTs have become really, really precise at picking up early cancer markers. We're still in the early days of the liquid biopsy space, but that's an area that is going to be increasingly important for catching things early. And once you do that, you just have far more options. So that's one vertical that we've been incredibly devoted in for quite a long time. The second one is something I mentioned earlier, which is immunotherapy. Mm-hmm. You know, ultimately, your body is the best defense mechanism that you have. Your body's so amazing. I'm always just in awe of it. And, you know, we've evolved for millions of years to combat infections and to combat cancer. Mm-hmm. All of us right now sitting in this audience have cells that are likely precancerous. And the reason why they don't advance is because 99.9% of the time, your body's immune system can recognize it and eliminate it. And optimizing those basic functions of your immune system are the core of the immunotherapy technologies that we have today. So getting those to where they are going to be is a huge area of ours. It's an imperfect analogy, but it's a little bit akin to, say, software in the early 80s, where it's still, you know, the province of you know, those who really are a little bit geekier. Right. And it's not really quite disseminated yet, but you can see the potential where it's going. And I would say the last area that we're focused on quite a lot is digital health, which is really a little bit more on the tech side of things. Mm-hmm. This is enabling services for clinical trial optimization, for care in the home, really to get patients what they need when they're in a clinical care setting, but also to try to help optimize the entire clinical trial system, which is wildly inefficient and runs on paper. It is still in the analog world. It's kind of amazing if you've ever been to a hospital lately, and I certainly hope you haven't, but it's kind of stunning. It's sort of like a time machine. You go back to the late 80s, and it's something that we just find completely unacceptable because the cost of patients are just too great.
Sure. I mean, everything about the hospital system is so anachronistic. It is just, gobsmacking. But what are you maybe seeing that it gives you hope about, regarding the democratization of clinical trials? I feel like I've been hearing about this for years. Obviously, we heard a little bit more about it during COVID. But what are there any companies in particular that you're excited about, or software systems that you think are actually like making an impact?
Totally. Okay, absolutely. 3% of cancer patients are in clinical trials. I just want to start with that statistic, which is
just three.
Really low.
Yeah.
Really, really low. And the reasons for this are quite interesting. Right now, most trials happen at major academic hospitals. If you're a big pharmaceutical company, that's where you go to recruit. And patient recruitment is by far the most costly and most time-intensive part of that whole process. Now, the good news is there is a law passed a while ago that says that you cannot really pay people to be in your trials, which is great because that could be abused quite easily if you had to, get financially induced to be in a trial.
Right.
Thank goodness that's not the case. However, that's actually tilted a bit too much because now it's really difficult for people to get reimbursed for things like transportation, housing, and work.
Yeah.
And when you're a patient, those can often be prohibitive costs. Mm. So what we've seen is the data we get is often really wealthy people who are Caucasian. And as we all know, that's a very narrow data set.
Right.
So what's happened, and COVID's been the key accelerant for this, is when COVID hit, cancer patients especially can't go to hospitals because they're full of COVID patients and they're immunosuppressed and they're very vulnerable. So trials got decentralized out into the private physician offices. Mm. And this made it so much more accessible. We've seen a massive uptick in participation. There's two really good companies right now that are doing this, Medibol and Section 32, but there's quite a lot more that are taking it even further. And that's actually Care in the Home, which is great for some places, and all types of other interesting new technologies to really bring us not into academic centers, but really meeting us where we are.
That's great. I do wonder on that front if, because of what happened during COVID, there have been challenges just in terms of, trust in science, and even if clinical trials are being made available, if people who should be partaking them are partaking them. I'm sure you don't have a silver bullet here, but I'm just wondering how much you think what went on set us back, if at all.
I think it's a big deal. Trust in science, they've been pulling this for about 50 years. It's not an all-time low, but it's close. And it is totally unacceptable to us that that's actually happening, particularly at this moment when we're actually seeing some efficacy finally in the cancer vaccine space. Of course, vaccines have really been lambasted by some folks who find them very unsafe. Mm. It's been a long-term goal to actually get your immune system to recognize cancer preemptively like it would for an infectious disease, which is, of course, why you get vaccines. Just a few months ago, there was a early phase one trial published, this is in the New York Times, that showed a 50% response in pancreatic cancer. 50%. It's wow. Never happened before.
Pancreatic cancer is one of the hardest things to diagnose, right? I feel like
it's, oh, absolutely. Yes. It's one of the hardest to diagnose. Yeah. It has it's a desert of success with therapies. Nothing ever works there. It's an early, it's an early phase one. It was only 6 out of 12 patients, so a very small sample size, but no one's ever really seen that before. So even right now, in some of the most difficult cancers, some of those new ideas are taking off. So the last thing any of us would want to see is a great cancer vaccine running into a lot of vaccine skepticism.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of other stuff that I know interests you, and I think, again, some people in the audience will be well acquainted with, but others won't. We were talking backstage about genetic engineering. And I was saying that kind of brings to mind, Dolly the sheep and designer babies. So maybe if you could disabuse anyone in the audience who's sort of worried about those two words together, what's happening on that front and what excites you, that would be great.
Absolutely. First of all, I think it's worth noting that these ethical concerns are really healthy to have. One of the key pioneers, Jennifer Doudna, who's right next door in Berkeley, has been really on the front lines of suggesting that we need to be, you know, doing research here with a lot of oversight, a lot of caution, and a lot of deliberation. And I could not agree more. And she's the most qualified person in the world to think so. However, right now, we are very, very, very far away from the, you know, designer baby scenario. What we have right now is the early stages of gene editing technology. So a good way to think about this is, if you think of ultimate gene editing as like copy-paste, you know, you have a bad thing, you want to replace it with a good thing. Mm-hmm. We are right now about 50% of the way there. We can cut with great single gene specificity, and that we can do quite well. But we can't paste. We're not good at putting in something better. So just off the bat, I would say our technology, you know, full stack for what we need to do is still very incomplete. And that's something that we're funding research on, and it's an area that we're very focused on. However, there's quite a lot that you can do with eliminating single things. So, for instance, sickle cell anemia is a major disease, particularly in the African-American population here. And it's caused by a single point mutation in your red blood cells. And it actually is the case where if you can knock out that one bad gene, your other, it's a dominant gene, your recessive gene, which is normal, can function well. And we're seeing early data of this disease actually being cured, truly cured with this single gene knockout. So right now there's several diseases that are, you know, they're called autosomal dominant, where it's one bad copy. Mm-hmm. Huntington's disease, which is a horrible neurodegenerative disease. Sickle cell is a great example as well. These things can be really knocked out with just single gene specificity, and we're already starting to see some of that. So those are the areas where we get really excited, and right now that's probably the limits of what we can do right now in humans.
Okay, great. Well, that sounds significant. What about epigenetic engineering? That's another thing that came up on our call, and I was like, Reed, explain it to me. Tell me what's so exciting there, and maybe what you're funding.
I'd love to. It's actually one of the areas that we're the most excited about. So if you think about epigenetics, a good way to kind of mentally model it is every cell in your body has the same DNA, right? But clearly, you know, your liver is significantly different than your skin. So the way that that works is, if you remember biology, your chromosomes, and you have 26 of them, you basically have your DNA rolled together with these various proteins. And you can chemically, without changing the DNA, turn on or off various areas of the genome. So your skin cell will just turn off all the liver genes. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need it, right? Well, how that works can actually now be perturbed, and we can change it a bit. And it turns out a lot of diseases are not caused by mutations or by the wrong gene. They're caused because gene expression goes down. Mm-hmm. A lot of neurodegenerative diseases, and actually a lot of autoimmune diseases, are caused because your immune system slows and it becomes exhausted, and it hasn't changed genetically. The expression levels go way down. And with what we're doing now, we can actually turn it back up. You can create a dial. And some other diseases, of course, are caused by things becoming hyperactive. So in those cases, you want to do the inverse. Mm. And that dial is really interesting, and you can actually touch a whole new class of diseases with it that are much, you know, more interesting than just actually going in and changing things. So that's another area that is distinct from gene editing, but it's actually probably going to happen in the clinic closer just because the safety is a lot better.
Great. I guess with either of these, are there sort of downsides that concern you? I mentioned sort of the obvious sort of cartoonish version of the concern about genetic engineering, but with epigenetic engineering, are there sort of concerns that you have about it being, used in wrong-headed ways?
Of course. Now, with any type of genetic or epigenetic perturbation, you're going to have really clear ethical guidelines for all this, which is why all of our companies publish data, all of our academics publish everything, and there's a really good ethical framework that's been developed internationally about how these things need to be developed, how they need to be disseminated and shared. And I'm happy to say that right now, everyone is really focused on mainly two areas. One is disease mitigation, and one is climate change. And there's actually huge applicability in both of those, and that's really where I'm spending all my time.
That's great. And tell me about the impacts of AI on what you're doing. I saw today that Mark Zuckerberg and Priscilla Chan announced that they're putting, I think, like $100 million into this generative AI, you know, computing power thingy. I'm just wondering if that's something that you've talked to them about or following, and just generally speaking, you know, what you expect the implications are here.
Sure. So Steve Quake, who's the scientific director of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, is someone who I interact with quite a bit professionally, absolute rock star, and his predecessor was as well. So they have some great people there. What they have done is actually, you know, in the last 10 years with building what they call a cell atlas at different universities is the perfect data set to actually put AI on top of. So to, just to answer your first question, what are we seeing with AI right now? It's pretty remarkable. What we're seeing is AI is making scientists significantly more productive by accelerating research, and it's also probably going to be accompanying them as they come up with different theses. So I'd say the two mechanisms of that is first, what we're seeing is a lot of great modeling, and this is what CZI is going to be working on, modeling protein folding, modeling genetic engineering, and doing that in actually a real 360 cell is going to accelerate development tremendously. It's hard to put a number on it, but it's a huge shift. And the second version, though, is really looking through all the scientific literature that's been published. I mean, when you're in medical school, you know, part of your job is to try to absorb all the scientific literature that, you know, has ever really been, you know, been made available, which is pretty impossible to do for a single person. And now what we're seeing is once that is actually filtered through a lot of really good next-gen AI algorithms, that is actually yielding insights that are getting to be pretty close to as good as what humans can do. And if you extrapolate out a few years, it'll probably be something that'll accompany researchers.
Terrific. You know, I just wanted to ask you, so you've been doing this for 5-7 years longer, possibly. What is the most impactful investment that you've made to date?
Oh, great question. We've been doing this for 8 years, and I would say by far the most impactful, I'll say a grant and investment. So there's a grant that we did at Yale, which I'm extremely proud of, which worked with their main hospital system to actually get clinical trial representation from across the state from a lot of physician providers. It worked great in Connecticut because it's a small state with like kind of one big academic medical hub in it. And they actually got representation to be demographically proportional, which I'm really, really proud of. That's the first for that entire institution. And on the company side, I would say one of the company that we're probably the most proud of is one called Tune Therapeutics. It's one in the epigenetic editing space. It's something that it was our first incubation that my team did before we joined Yosemite while we were at Emerson. And it was, I'm really proud of it because at the level that we're at across all these labs, we were able to see connections that were obscure to even the best researchers in the world. We paired up the best expert on this type of editing plus the delivery mechanisms that you're going to need to get into cells. And they didn't even know each other. So we actually introduced them in my living room and sketched out the business plan. And I'm just proud to say it's really become a leader in the space in the last 3 years.
Terrific. And, you know, so you mentioned incubating this company. Is incubation a big part of what you're going to be doing at Yosemite? And if so, how does that sort of differ when you're talking about giving these very early stage grants to scientists? I guess, should they be worried that you're going to be competing with them?
We don't think so at all. So, of course, incubation is a huge part of what we do. As you can imagine, scientists really begin in this journey because they want to see a change in patients. They're not in this to make a lot of money or necessarily to have a great academic post. They're really in it to solve a problem. And companies are the only vehicle that exists to really do that at scale. So entrepreneurs and academics could not be more excited to actually get things into the market as quickly as possible. And for us, since we take no IP or royalty strings at all, our view is that we hope to be, you know, their first port of call. However, the onus is on us to earn it. If they go with another firm, that is because we haven't earned it. and we need to do better.
And do you have a lot of competition? I mean, obviously there are lots of, you know, health sciences investors. Are more people, I mean, I feel like I'm talking to more people who are focused on or very interested in learning about the intersection of AI and healthcare. Are you seeing that on the ground?
Absolutely. However, one big difference between tech and biotech is that in the life sciences, early companies are much more capital intensive than what you have in the early stage on the tech side. So yes, it's competitive, but elbows are a little less sharp simply because a Series A, it will not be $6 million. It'll be closer probably to $50 million.
Right. In terms of, I guess, what you are going to be funding at Emerson, so it's a $200 million fund. Have you made any investments yet?
Yes, I'm proud to say we have. We had a few things that we were really, really excited to debut with, and those include a next-generation gene editing delivery platform, a really interesting new startup that just came out of MIT, and another one that is out of Yale that we're about to close, and I can't talk about that one yet because it's not done, but it's going to be really, really cool.
Well, based on your sort of view into all of these different sort of verticals, do you have any reason to think that cancer will not be a chronic disease versus fatal in the next 25 years? I mean, what is your, I've heard you say something about the next century, but do you think we could even be closer, or do you think even that's maybe too ambitious?
Well, I'm all for being ambitious. Biotech is never as linear as tech. It's always actually, it abounds in mystery and difficulty, which can be very exciting. What I believe is that the major cancers which claim most lives are right now seeing the greatest progress. And that really enervates me. That's lung, it's breast, it's prostate, colon. Those are the really, really big killers. And I do believe that in the next 20 years, we're going to see a very significant decrease in mortality there. Of course, cancer is a very heterogeneous population, so there will be a few outliers. You know, if I had to speculate, cancers like ovarian, brain, and unfortunately pancreatic are going to be a bit more difficult. They have low mutational rates. They're hard to detect. They have these weird, horrible microenvironments that are very suppressive to anything, you know, really getting in there. And I think, unfortunately, those will likely sort of be the final outliers. And we will stay on to the end here at Yosemite. We are not going anywhere. We're really not going to go out of business until we see mortality decline to a level that people don't die of cancer anymore.
I love it. Reed, we're going to have to go here in a second, but I also just wanted to talk to you as a Bay Area native.
Yes.
The San Francisco Bay Area has obviously gotten a lot of grief. I'm just wondering, do you want to sort of tell us why you think people have it wrong?
Well, I am likely the most biased person you're ever going to talk to, because I was born in Palo Alto, I went to Stanford, and I very proudly have lived in San Francisco for the last 9 years. I think Bay Area is the most beautiful place in the world, and it will always be home. You know, the Bay Area, if you look historically, has been a lot like a phoenix. It has had booms and busts that have been extremely volatile all throughout its history. And every time, you know, there's a bit of a downturn, there's always a lot of naysayers and, oh, you know, this is the end. What were we thinking? And consistently that has been proved wrong. And already, I promise you, already there are companies, young companies that are very excited to be here, talent that doesn't want to look anywhere else, and capital. And you mentioned AI earlier. AI is not happening in other parts of the country.
Right.
It's happening here in San Francisco.
Yeah. No, it's exciting, and you can just see the energy. I mean, obviously at this show, but elsewhere, I mean, the restaurants are buzzing, people are out on the streets, and it's just, it feels like the city has really come back. I mean, obviously we have problems to overcome, but...
That's exactly right. Well, I see we're at time. I actually just want to end by thanking you for putting on such a wonderful inaugural event. Congratulations.
Thanks. It's amazing. Thank you so much. And thank you all.
Now, here is Connie's interview with Katie Hahn, CEO and founder of Hahn Ventures.
Katie, I'm so glad that you're here. I know that you could be in New York at a big crypto event, and we really appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Connie. Here.
So it has been about 2 years, just shy of 2 years, since the last time that the two of us sat down together, and much has changed. So at the time, you were a general partner with Andreessen Horowitz. Bitcoin was trading at $65,000, and Sam Bankman-Fried was riding high at FTX. Today, you are running your own fund. Bitcoin is not at $65,000 a piece, and so much has happened. I mean, FTX is gone. We've had Celsius, Three Arrows Capital, et cetera, et cetera. How did you ride out the turmoil?
Well, we're still riding out the turmoil, actually, Connie, and I think some of the things that you mentioned that happened in the space set the space back considerably. So let's back up and talk about what happened. I think the gentleman who introduced us said that it was 1 year ago we raised our fund, and it was actually not 1 year ago. I thought, wow, that was a fast year then, but actually it's been almost 2 years, not quite. We'll be 2 years old, actually come next year, Q1. So writing out the turmoil, I think one of the things is zooming out what happened. You mentioned FTX, you mentioned a number of other debacles that have happened in this space. And I think there was also a macro correction going on. Obviously, crypto prices were down and starting to go down, actually, because I believe the last peak was November 2021. As you mentioned, FTX had raised a large round, and it was not only FTX that raised a large valuation. It was a lot of other companies and projects in the space. So riding out the turmoil, we are still riding out the turmoil. As I said, a couple of those things set the industry back, in my estimation, years.
I guess, what are the red flags that you saw that others seemingly missed?
Well, I don't really want to look backward. I mean, looking forward, what I can tell you about is what we look for in our founders, because that's how we're approaching the space. So one of the things we look for first right off the bat is, first of all, we look for no conflicts. I mean, it's hard sometimes in crypto, but in traditional venture, I think this was very much something that folks looked for. And being on the board of Coinbase, I'm now on my third board term with Coinbase, so I was always kind of team Coinbase, and so really was never going to invest in FTX for that reason alone. Sure. So we didn't even get past go. Okay. But another point is, one of the things we look for in our founders is, who do we want to spend really the next 10 years in business with? And obviously, we bias, being in crypto, we bias toward highly technical founders. But we also bias toward founders who do have a certain degree in humility in certain things. They might be obsessive about a few different areas. Maybe it's product. Maybe it's recruiting, engineering. But they have the humility to know that they don't know everything. I've yet to meet a subject matter domain expert in absolutely everything. But I have met plenty of founders who think they are domain Sure. experts in everything. So we look for founders who have that humility, who we want to enter into really a 10-year partnership with. And those are some of the things that we look for. We also look for, frankly, we know that regulations and laws are important. The gentleman who introduced us mentioned I was a federal prosecutor for a decade. And so that's something that's still very important to me and also to our team, because it's not just me. We have 12 people, and a number of us used to work in the government.
Sure, and congratulations on building your team. You know, I did want to ask, so in preparation for this interview, I was watching a clip of you on stage last year in the Bahamas with Sam Bankman-Fried being interviewed by Michael Lewis, the writer. And, you know, speaking of Coinbase, yep. Sam spent like uninterrupted 7 minutes talking about everything that was wrong with all these other crypto exchanges. They were broken. People were no longer innovating. And you just sort of sat there quietly smiling. And I'm just wondering now what you were thinking as that was happening.
Well, actually, I remember, and I don't know if it came out on the video because it was a large audience. I had just stood up my firm. And one of the reasons I was there was it was a very important industry conference at the time. I was building a team. I was recruiting people. There were a lot of different founders who were there. And I remember actually getting booed because of what you said. I was very much team Coinbase, and the audience, by and large, was a lot of FTX supporters.
Right.
The only other time, I think I've met him two or three times, the only other time I shared a stage with him was behind closed doors, so I won't say too much about it, but I can tell you also, I was talking about governance, and there were some awkward moments where he was saying other things.
Things were not registering. Yeah. Well, I did kind of wonder, you know, wearing your former federal prosecutor's hat, his trial kicks off in 2 weeks. What are you going to be looking for? What should we maybe be looking for?
Well, what do you mean in terms of what should we be looking for? I think
I'm just wondering
a lot of the case. I think a lot of the case is out there in the indictment already. Mm-hmm. But of course, we've all been surprised by more and more bombshells. I think, as a stepping back into my shoes as a prosecutor, one of the things that you do is you will continue to gather evidence right up in witnesses, right mm-hmm. up until the moment. I guess one thing that we might be looking for, and of course, the government will have already had to produce this, is their witness list. So who is going to take the stand against him?
Yeah.
That's one thing I'd look for. I did tell everyone at the time, and I maintain this position, that I do think he will get a very lengthy jail sentence.
It's looking that way. We'll all be watching with bated breath. Early last year, so between, was it like March of 2022-ish?
When we raised our fund?
Yes,
April. Actually, April 2022.
Okay.
March, April.
It was a big deal, though. You raised a $1.5 billion fund. Well, actually, you raised two funds. One was a $500 million early stage fund. Then you raised this $1 billion acceleration fund. So much was made of that number. It's one of the biggest debut funds ever. It's the biggest fund that a woman has ever raised. You know, it's kind of funny, I guess, because you and I had sat down publicly shortly before that, people were reaching out to me to ask if I could introduce them to you, which has never happened before. So I guess I'm just wondering, how much interest did you really have? Because I'm guessing it was above even what you raised.
Well, I think there were two real misperceptions with our fund that still persist. One misperception about our fund, as you mentioned, is that it's one big fund, and it's not. It's two funds, and I'll address that in a second. But I think another misperception is, oh, wow, you raised at the height of the market. Great timing, peak. That was not the case. We definitely raised at a much easier time, to be sure, than we would now. And we're not going to be out fundraising for a very long time, can tell you that. But at the time that we were raising our fund and talking with institutional LPs in the first quarter of 2022, a lot was happening already. It was not a walk in the park. Number one, crypto market cap had dropped 40%. People forget that. So there was already tremendous sharp decline in crypto prices. 40%, again, from its peak in, I think it was November 2021. Yeah. So that was the first thing. The global macro picture was really shifting under our feet in real time. That was already going on. Inflation, rate hikes. And then, of course, also before we closed our fund, Russia invaded Ukraine.
Right.
And I could go on and on with other things that were starting to happen in the crypto space. Of course, things continued to happen in the crypto space and in the global macro picture. But we were not closing our fund at a time when LPs weren't worried about volatility. They were. And I think one of the things I'm very grateful for is that we have LPs who know that this is going to be volatile. We addressed that, and we talked extensively to them about the volatility in crypto. On my team, several of us have been in the space for a decade or more already. And so we knew from our experience with prior cycles that there would be volatility. And we have LPs that have that long-term view. The other big misperception about our fund is we're one huge, enormous $1.5 billion fund. And we're not. We have two funds. We have an early stage fund, $500 million. We do seed, A, and B. Mm-hmm. And then we have an acceleration fund, which backs all kinds of later stage projects in crypto. And there are
tokens.
Mm-hmm. And a handful of later stage, you know, kind of pre-IPO, you can call it, companies in this space. And so we have those two funds. No, to answer your question, Connie, we did not take every dollar available to us. That's definitely not the case. I can tell you that today. The size was purposeful of those two funds. I call it kind of the Goldilocks size. One, we wanted to be big enough to compete with some of the other top crypto funds. And we also wanted to work with the best founders who often are looking for funds that can support them through multiple cycles of their journey, seed, A, B, et cetera. So those two fund strategies turn out to be quite a bit different. And it's not one huge fund. And the pacing is very different, and the strategy is also very different. And the companies that we end up backing are very different.
Right. Sure. And I want to get into your strategies. I did want to ask one question. It's out there. You've got some sovereign wealth funds behind you. This is true of a lot of people in the industry. One of them is a public investment fund, which has also backed Founders Fund, Tiger Global, many, many other funds. There is sort of this angst with U.S. companies partnering more closely with Saudi Arabia, from PE to VC mm-hmm. to the PGA. I'm just wondering if that was at all a difficult decision, or if you can just sort of talk about that for a second.
I think just a correction. It's not actually the Pifund.
But it's their backing.
Snabble.
Yes.
And then also another entity there, a university entity.
Okay.
And I think we're very proud of our LPs. As you said, it's a diverse set. It's a very global set of sovereign wealth funds, of foundations, of hospital systems, of an Ivy League endowments. I mean, so it's a very diverse and global set, and we feel very lucky to have all of them. I think one of the things we do is we definitely follow what the U.S. government is also doing in making our decisions about that, about who to take.
Okay, that's interesting. Right. Well, it's a great point. I see what you're saying. How much do you have of the fund left to invest 18 months later?
Yeah, so I don't want to slap a number on it, and I'm not sure that these funds are public. I have to be so careful now that what I say isn't investment advice, We are a registered investment advisor with the SEC, so I want to be very careful about exact percentages, but I can give you ballpark.
Okay.
I think of our, and this is very ballpark, but of our later stage fund, we have not yet deployed about half of it.
Okay.
Maybe even a little more than half. And of our earlier stage fund, it's considerably less than that. We are making new investments. One of the things that happened is we were waiting for the markets to correct. We're still very busy. I think there's a perception out there that, oh, crypto, it's crickets chirping. We find ourselves very busy. But one of the things we did do is we saw this market correction, and we very purposefully waited to make some deployments. And I can get into that with our strategy. So I know this is going to sound a little odd, but we feel actually it's a really good time to be investing in the space during this down market.
Sure. I'm sure prices are a lot better than they've ever
been. Well, that's
certainly
true.
Got to have a lot of leverage. I wanted to ask, if you were to go out today, just sort of to gauge the market, if you think you could raise as much as you did when you did, if you would want to raise as much as you did, I saw that Blockchain Capital just announced $500 million in funds. I'm just wondering what you think the market can support. Right,
I mean, I don't want to speculate on it because we are nowhere, as I said, our approximate percentages of deployed. So we're nowhere near thinking about fundraising right now. I think what I could tell you, and we've seen in crypto with our experience in crypto, and frankly, all of tech is going through a similar cycle right now. We've just seen it before in crypto. In a shorter time frame, things change so dramatically from 1 year to the next. I mean, you've seen crypto market caps swing wildly, and I don't want to say what conditions would be in a year, in 2 years. What I can tell you is that we were very deliberate and thoughtful about who we partnered with. We also took LPs who we thought had strategic value, including for the projects that we're backing. We are backing U.S. projects. We're also backing projects globally. And so that was very much in mind. We have brands that are strategic. You mentioned sovereign wealth funds. We talked about foundations, endowments. But we also have huge corporate global brands that everyone in this room would have heard of who we think are very strategic.
Can you share any? That's...
I don't think I can. Some of them have shared.
Okay.
So it's findoutable.
Okay.
As we would have said when I was a prosecutor. But we actually don't disclose our LPs per the terms of our LPA agreement, but you can go look. Some of them have disclosed that they participated in our fund. And why was I saying that? What were we talking about? We were talking what did you asked me a question about fundraising.
Oh, I think I just asked if you would raise what you raised now.
Oh, so what I was going to say is one thing we were purposefully, because we did at that time, as I said, did not take every dollar. So we did have our choice of LPs at the time. And I don't know what things would hold in the future, but I can tell you that we made very clear we were interested in large partners who would make multi-fund commitments.
Great.
If I have my way, we will never have to take another LP again because we love our existing set of LPs. And the other thing I would say is we don't intend to, I know this sounds in 2023 sitting here like an obvious thing, but we don't intend to ever increase our fund size no matter what the market is. And by the way, I'm sitting here publicly stating this on the record in a tape setting. Even if the market, if it's a massive crypto bull run, we don't ever intend to increase our size. We think we picked our size and our strategy for a reason.
That's great. So let's talk a little bit about your strategy. You obviously know which companies to avoid. what is interesting to you right now?
Yeah. So again, this gets back to which fund we're talking about. Let me talk about our acceleration fund. And I think the kind of use cases, or at least some of the companies that we're interested in, will be more familiar to this audience because they are a little bit more mainstream. They tend toward more financial use cases, picks and shovels, custodians, and the like. And for that acceleration fund, that you can think of that fund as the We call it the It's Working Fund. Things are already working. These are not early stage. They're not very experimental. They're, in many cases, they're businesses with clear revenue models already, with metrics. And by the way, we've just done two deals we haven't announced yet. They're companies that are very known in crypto. They're iconic brands. They've grown even during this trough. And they have revenue, and they have customers, and they have metrics that will look very familiar to some of the folks in this room who invest, or some of founders who are creating metrics. They're very traditional metrics that one can measure and growth that one can measure. And one of the things I'm very excited about is these are teams that we've known for years. Again, I've been in the space now for a decade. Mm-hmm. Some of my team has too. Many of them were early Coinbase employees.
Okay.
And so these are teams that were known to us. And I think what happened is, smartly, some of these teams raised a lot of money during prior cycles. And so they have kind of war chests now, so they don't need to raise capital again. So they're not raising more primary capital. But because of the relationship and the work that they knew we would put in, and my team would put in on behalf of these companies, mm-hmm. they wanted to partner with us. Now, problem, we raised at this time when, although I said it was a 40% correction, it still hadn't corrected as far as it has now. The valuations were pretty high. And one of the things I have to do for my LPs and for our LPs is deliver venture-style returns. And I did not have the confidence to think, okay, at these valuations, I can really deliver what are true venture-style returns, which is my fiduciary obligation. What to do? We couldn't get involved. However, with the markets correcting so much, and again, it's not just crypto. It's all of the technology markets and public markets. These companies also were no exception. As I said, we were in touch with the founding teams even when we weren't investors, and we developed what we call our harpoon strategy. We knew the price at which we would be able to get involved and feel confident that we could deliver venture-style returns, and that's exactly what we've done this year, which is why that number is hovering somewhere around the 50% deployment rate. We have gone out and we have acquired pretty meaningful stakes in some later-stage companies that I feel like are iconic crypto businesses.
That's great. Let's make news. Tell us what they are.
I think I told you, I think what I committed to do is that I would tell you first.
Oh, that's right. That's right. So you better call me in 2 weeks. I'm hoping
But we will. It's not up to me. It's up to the founders of those businesses when we can announce those deals. But I'm very excited about them and their teams that I've known for years and feel very excited about. So that's on the later stage fund. On the early stage fund, you know, people often think, oh, that's crypto? That's a crypto business. It is a crypto business because how we think of crypto really is cryptography paired with economic incentives. So that's how we think of crypto when we think of a crypto business. And that leads to things like, I know, Connie, you've asked me before about zero knowledge proofs.
Yes.
Zero knowledge proofs are something that I feel like we're seeing a lot of experimentation in, a lot of development in. There are some zero knowledge proof protocols that are going to launch in the next year that really have nothing to do with the financial case in crypto. There are things like, let me give you one kind of use case. And this is not a demonstrated use case yet, by the way, but this is one thing that you might use a zero knowledge proof for: age verification online. This is something many enterprises and people need to do. Mm-hmm. And zero knowledge proofs are a way to do that in a more secure fashion.
Sure.
It's really, zero knowledge proofs are kind of a breakthrough in cryptography. So that's one example. One of our portfolio companies, Alio, is an example of that. But we're also seeing more of the infrastructure stuff out of the early stage fund, and I'm very lucky that our deal team, we have an early engineer from Coinbase and Zora. We have someone from Index Ventures, and then, of course, we've got another deal partner who came from Coinbase Ventures. So these are people who have been on the lookout for these kinds of technologies for a long time, and now they're starting to come online. It's developer tooling plays, like things like Third Web, which is a portfolio company that we've announced that's based right here in San Francisco, and they're building developer tools. It is, in the early stage fund, it's a lot more infrastructure facing. People say, well, what are the use cases? Which I think is a very fair question that few people in crypto answer, and I'm happy to answer that. On the early side stage of things, though, the use cases, really the end user still of early stage crypto projects, are developers.
Okay.
So they're not as much consumer facing. Now, that could change, mm-hmm. and we've seen that change quickly. What we saw in the last cycle of crypto was that enthusiasm got a little bit ahead of technical progress. And so we're seeing some of the corrections there now. And a lot of infrastructure is getting built. You hear things like sovereign roll-ups, like one of our portfolio companies in our early stage that we led the seed round for was called Sovereign Labs. They're building sovereign roll-ups. So this is very infrastructure, very developer facing, whereas again, the later stage fund, a little more consumer facing, more financial institution architecture. So hopefully that addresses a little bit about the strategy.
Well, yeah, when you talk about later stage companies that you may be getting involved in, I mean, I just always think of like the biggest brands that, you know, we sort of emerged in the last couple of years, and most of them are consumer facing. Some of them are NFT companies. I did want to ask you, so one of your companies I saw announced was Zora Labs, which is an NFT marketplace.
Yep.
Does that compete with OpenSea?
Not really.
Okay.
Not really. They're very different companies. Okay. As you know, we're very involved with OpenSea. I was very involved with OpenSea, and I'm still very excited, even though the volumes are so far down. I'm very excited about the concept of digitally scarce goods. And I think you have to really think about why that is. I think the acronym NFTs, or non-fungible tokens, gets really associated, especially in the media and especially by consumers, fairly so, with a really niche thing that's very inaccessible to many to use. It's also inaccessible to many and to most to buy.
Mm-hmm.
People think of these high-priced profile pictures. And of course, one of the early iterations of NFTs were that, right? They were...
Bored apes.
They were... You needed specialized software to use, or a special wallet, whether it's MetaMask, whether it's Coinbase. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a really easy consumer experience.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you step back, one of the things that's still interesting to me about digitally scarce goods, and I've always called them that, I called them that even prior cycles, not NFTs, but digitally scarce goods, is that they're a new business model for the internet. And it's so early days. I think that it started with art and collectibles, and we've talked about that.
Yeah.
But I think that what people don't realize is that brands are still doing these around things like gaming, around things like fashion. So you've had Nike... You've had LVMH, you've had Starbucks, still experimenting right now with digitally scarce goods. They're just not calling it NFTs. They're not calling it digitally scarce goods. Why do I even find that exciting at all? Or why do I think that it would grow in the future? I think that more and more of our lives are digital. I think that eyeballs on screens are up and to the right. Mm-hmm. And I think that in that world, it will be important to enforce digital scarcity and as consumers to actually own goods. That today, when we own a digital good, we don't own it. We don't possess the properties.
I'm not convinced that people need to, I guess, own things. I mean, just based on, people are lazy. You know, the last time we talked, we were talking about maybe Royal. We were talking about music NFTs, and you were explaining, and I understand that it would be great if artists got better economics for their hard work, but... It's still complicated, and you know, why would you not just go to Spotify and listen to the song that you want? And do you care about owning it? Not really,
well,
as long as you can hear it.
The reality is that people say they value privacy, but they really value convenience, right?
Yes.
We've seen that time and time again. And I completely agree with you, by the way, Connie, right now.
Yeah.
But the infrastructure is changing. And I think that where we're making bets, don't forget, we're not a crypto hedge fund. We're not trading in and out of tokens, in and out of companies. What we're doing is we're making bets for 7 to 10 years from now.
Mm.
And one of the things I've tried to be careful not to do is be dismissive of technologies that a lot of people, frankly, don't see the use of early on, think, well, I wouldn't use that. I mean, look at Twitch. I remember hearing about Twitch, and I thought, why would anyone want to watch someone else play a game?
Right.
But I've thought that about a lot of things, and I've been wrong.
Right.
And so I think we're not an NFT fund. We're doing a lot more than just that, but certainly we are making select investments. Still, that is an important, I think, sector in the space. And you mentioned Zora. One of the things that Zora is doing is trying to make it cheaper and easier for people for free to mint things for creators. So I think Zora is really focused more on the creator. And so we're very excited about it.
That's great. You know, so I'm sure you hear this all the time, and I don't doubt, you know, probably 2 years from now when we sit down again, the market will be hopping. But when you look at AI, I just feel like AI is something that people can, you know, grok. Like the efficiencies are in sight. Everybody is already benefiting from it. With crypto and these, you know, blockchain, it's complicated. And I think it just seems like we keep talking about it as a new industry, but it is...
Yeah.
You know, 10 years in. So, I mean, what do you think is going to change that? What, you know, where will we see a tipping point?
Yeah.
Well,
guess? I mean, obviously, I don't know the answer to where we will see the tipping point. Mm-hmm. Where will the tipping point come? But I can tell you that one thing is people are not paying attention. They say, oh, you know, what's going on in crypto? They think you know, questions that you asked me within the beginning around companies that have failed, but they are missing some of the news. I mean, again, having been through three cycles, we've heard that the space is dead, actually, in all three cycles, before,
right.
Every single one. And as my team says, who are Game of Thrones fans, what's dead may never die. But in all seriousness, the thing that happened, even just this year alone, some of that, it's been a year of lowlights, make no mistake, but it's also been a year of some highlights. I mean, just this week alone, you saw PayPal announcing a stablecoin on Venmo. That's a really big deal. Visa also announced earlier this year that they're going to be experimenting with stablecoins. Also a big deal. I don't think you would have the world's largest asset managers, from BlackRock to Fidelity and beyond, filing crypto ETFs if it were a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. I think those of us who are following the space day to day, which is what we're doing, we see also technical progress. We see developer activity up. Again, those end users or customer use cases. Really, we're still at the point in crypto of infrastructure phase, developer facing. Sure. And so breakthroughs in cryptography. But also, let's not forget the merge happened just under a year ago. Mm. On Ethereum. And the merge was really significant, but it wasn't really focused on by many people in mainstream media. It got some attention. Yeah. But had that happened when prices were high, it would have gotten a whole lot more attention. I mean, the merge was the largest software upgrade ever with almost no downtime. Actually, I think it was zero downtime, all while supporting billions and billions of dollars in volume. And that's pretty significant if you think about it. And that was years in the making. And had that happened when crypto prices were high, I guarantee every single person out there would have been talking about the merge. But because crypto has a bug and a feature of this real-time price ticker feed attached to everything, it really, some of the things go unnoticed. And, you know, I've seen irrationality on the way up in every single cycle. And I have also seen irrationality also on the way down.
Sure. That's how it always works, right? Well, we're running out of time, but of course, we haven't even talked about the biggest, I guess, obstacle to date, which is one of the biggest obstacles, regulation. As an investor, you mentioned that you are, I think you mentioned at some point earlier that you are investing in U.S. companies, but mm-hmm. are you less inclined going forward? I mean, are you hesitant to invest in American companies because regulation here remains so uncertain?
We're not hesitant to invest in U.S. companies. Mm-hmm. We invest in U.S. companies, and we will continue to do so. Mm-hmm. What I would say is the same thing I've said for actually now several years, which is that the law and the regulations are decided in this country by the courts and by Congress. They're not decided by independent agencies. So just because an agency says something doesn't really make it the law.
Right.
And I think a lot of folks don't realize that. And so we've seen agencies and we've seen certain branch of government get really involved. And by the way, different administrations too. This is bipartisan. Get very, very involved. And I think what we're starting to see now is our system of checks and balances starting to work. So I've been saying for years, it's going to be going to court and courts are going to tell us what the rules are. And that's happening. In fact, in the last month, we've had a trio of losses in one agency, the SEC's position, by three different federal judges. In fact, in one case, Connie, it was a three-judge panel of the D.C. Circuit, a very ideologically diverse panel, unanimous. The D.C. Circuit is one step removed from the U.S. Supreme Court. And they said that the agency had acted arbitrarily and capriciously and sent them back the proposal to do their job over again. So I think that the court is starting to push back. By the way, Congress is starting to say, wait a second, this is a really major area of the economy and could be national security. We're going to start getting involved too. You had bipartisan two different committees, both in the House, and then you also had in the Senate legislation being introduced at the committee level. That's never happened before. And that's never happened before, nor has, I told you, the world's largest asset managers entered before. Stable coins now, last in 2022, were $6.87 trillion of volume. Wow. The IRS just issued guidance. Honestly, Connie, I know this is a very contrarian take. That's what we do as investors. But I will tell you that I have actually never felt that in prior cycles, crypto was more inevitable than in this cycle. And this is the fourth cycle I've been in crypto. And the reason is you've got the IRS passing guidance. Like I said, you've got legislation being proposed. It's not passed, but it's proposed. Bipartisan. That's just in the U.S. We have not talked about internationally and globally, and of course, crypto being open source 24/7, distributed from the get-go globally. I think it's really important to also look at what's happening globally, and the picture's brighter on what's happening globally. You have a majority of G20 countries now moving forward with crypto frameworks.
Yeah.
You have countries like the UK, like Japan, then Abu Dhabi, like the BRIC countries, as they call them, BRIC countries, now starting to pass frameworks also. I think these aren't like small nations that folks haven't really done a lot of business in. These are very sophisticated economies, and I think that right now they're moving forward because they realize the inevitability of cryptography paired with economic incentives.
Do you think Gary Gensler, the SEC chief, knows what he's doing?
Well, I hope he does, but I will say that courts have started disagreeing with his position. I think he is, I don't want to make it personal to him. I think the SEC under his chairship has really taken a very expansive view of their jurisdiction in a way that I think, by the way, make no mistake, it's not just crypto. It's on AI, it's on climate, it's on other major policy questions that concern the U.S. economy. And I think that's a bit concerning because that's not how our system is set up. Our system is set up for that's saved for the courts. And I think that's why you've started to see some federal judges, not connected federal judges, right? You've got a federal judge in New York, you've got a 3-judge panel in Washington, D.C., starting to say, wait a second, this is a step too far. But I think invariably, like most agencies, they'll probably get some wins and get some losses. I will say, unfortunately, despite companies like Coinbase and others calling for more regulatory clarity for a number of years in the space, none came, and we had all of the debacles that you talked about. And I think what's going on now is regulators need to prove that they're the tough cop on the beat, and they're going after whatever they can, even if they might not ultimately prevail.
Sure. Last question, and thank you for sticking around. So SBF's trial kicks off in 2 weeks. Just wondering, do you think it's going to sort of bookend this chapter, or do you think it could hurt the industry even further?
I think it will be nice to have some closure on this chapter, but I would say that I'm not making any predictions here at all, but I will say in my experience as a federal prosecutor, trials can get continued. I'm not saying it would happen here or that I'm actually not following it as closely as you might think I would be, because we're really focused on the future. But it's possible it gets continued. I hope it doesn't. I hope it goes forward. And I do think that it would be nice for the industry to have a bit of resolution there and also see that a large financial fraudster is brought to justice.
Yeah.
That's the former prosecutor in me talking.
Great. Katie, thank you so much. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Connie.
Really appreciate it.
That's it. Thanks for listening, everybody, and a special thanks to Affinity. Check them out at affinity.co. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you back here next week.